Bristol is our community. Bristol Community FM 93.2.
Welcome back to BCFM's politics show, Friday Drive Time, with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Why has it taken nearly 20 years for Stephen Lawrence's brutal racist murder case to get a proper trial? We hear from investigative journalist Laurie Flynn, who published a book, The Untouchables, in 2004, explaining how and why the Lawrence case was kicked into the long grass, and why police and media corruption, he believes, went all the way to the top. And Laurie is a former World in Action reporter. Plus, the former head of MI5 says she wants to decriminalise cannabis so the police can focus on the drugs associated with burglary, violence and organised crime. Steve Barker from the Legalised Cannabis Alliance believes cannabis was only up to Class B so the police could divert attention away from arresting crack and heroin dealers, but still tick their boxes. And the Tenth Crusade. More noises this week that NATO may attack or invade Syria and Iran. But is this just like the medieval crusades, a war for plunder under the guise of religion, and a Goldman Sachs financing it all? Well, Professor Anthony Hall has written a new book about propaganda of empire building since 1492, and he believes the formula is essentially the same. Nothing much has changed for the last 400 years. Plus, Eddie James is here to talk about Bristol's great business rate scam. But first, the harrowing Stephen Lawrence case returned to the courts this week. The brutal murder nearly 20 years ago has taken far too long to solve. But why? Former World in Action reporter and investigative journalist Laurie Flynn believes he knows why.
My name's Laurie Flynn. I'm the co-author of a book about corruption in the Metropolitan Police called The Untouchables. The other author is a younger man called Michael Gillard Jr., who I met, first of all, socially. He's the son of a very good friend and former colleague of mine when I was working at Granada's World in Action program. It's a very good practice in complex investigations to have two brains rather than one brain working on them, and we enjoyed one another's company. We also had another series of stories that we wanted to explore. One of those centered on police officers and police operations that we thought were very dubious indeed and were being very, very poorly managed. And we started to explore those operations and soon came up with a strong resonance for the background of the tragic Stephen Lawrence murder and the persistent failure of the Metropolitan Police to arrest the father of one of the boys who killed Stephen, who was by this time a major league drugs criminal. So we started to explore the background to the failure to arrest this man, and soon discovered that there were several other very important unsolved murders in the same police district in South East London, principally the murder of a police informant and drugs criminal called David Norris, and the murder of a private detective called Daniel Morgan. The more we dug into this, the more Simi doesn't even begin to describe how appalling the policing standards were in this part of London. And it seemed that not merely were murders unsolved, but that the murder inquiries were deliberately derailed by corrupt police officers. We went from being very popular at The Guardian to being very unpopular at The Guardian, because as soon as we fastened onto these issues, the Met hierarchy at the highest level started working behind the scenes to open up a space between ourselves and our bosses at The Guardian. How they did this was quite simple. The Guardian is a great newspaper, and there are many fine and talented journalists who work on it. But the linkage between all newspapers and all commercial media and the police, particularly the Metropolitan Police, is a very tight and taut linkage indeed. There's a saying, if it bleeds, it leads. In other words, the commercial media are extremely dependent on police contacts, police sources, favours, access to crime scenes. And this granting of favours is orchestrated and has been orchestrated over fairly many years to create a thoroughly improper relationship between so-called independent journalists and operational police officers. We can now see this coming to the very front of the news 7 years after we published our book, with the extraordinary revelations about the interpenetration of the Yard and the News of the World, where police officers are working corruptly for the News of the World, and lots of ex-News of the World journalists and executives have inserted themselves into the hierarchy of the Yard, and indeed into the hierarchy of British politics at large.
That was Laurie Flynn there, author of the book The Untouchables, and also a reporter for World in Action all those years ago. Martin here, he's talking about really the granting of favours. So there's two things there. One is the whole, but let's look at first of all this whole idea of granting of favours by the police to certain press outlets.
Well, obviously that can lead to manipulation and improper behaviour. But coming back to the original story about Stephen Lawrence, I used to live in that part of South London when all of this happened, and the word on the street was very clear that the bent coppers involved in the case, the boys who carried out the attack, their father was the biggest dope dealer in South London. Yeah, he was a big importer, and they thought they could get away with it because daddy had loads of cops on the payroll, and when they dug into it, various other murders in South East London were not properly investigated again, because the improper relationship was not between police and journalists, that's improper enough, between police and gangsters, which is the really serious bit.
So
of course that's the problem with the illegal drugs market. Those kind of relationships become endemic, and I understand that police officers went round to the house where the boys who had carried out the attack or had been accused of carrying out the attack lived, and took away bin bags full of evidence to protect their fella who was their father. Okay, that was the word on the street in South London when I used to live.
And that's basically what Laurie's saying there, and that this is just one of several cases in that part of in that police district where there was just, it wasn't just that trials didn't run their proper course, there was very much a proactive stance from that particularly dodgy police district, it seems, to derail these trials.
Yes, because basically some police officers were in cahoots with the local gangsters.
But how is that possible, to derail the course of justice? I mean, that surely is a serious offence in itself.
It happens all over the world. Serious police officers know very well that one of their main tasks is rooting out the bad lot in their own ranks. And it's a large proportion of what they do. When Paul Condon took over as head of the Met in the 1980s, he gave a press conference. He said, the bad news, folks, is that 250 of my officers, I think it was 250, are corrupt, are working with the gangsters. The good news is we know who they are and we're keeping an eye on them. Can we get rid of them? No, because they're all trained police officers. They never speak to anybody without their briefs. And basically, most police forces, my uncle used to be in the Wolverhampton police, they've got, you know, 10% plus who are crooked, and they have to spend a lot of time dealing with those people. It's one of the things serious police forces always have to do.
Bristol Community FM 93.2.
Now, 2 years ago, Gordon Brown moved to abolish business rate relief. This is where businesses had been paying very little or no business rates for their commercial buildings because the owners of those buildings were keeping them empty. But this led to several buildings on Temple Way, for example, being demolished by landowners who'd rather do that than rent the buildings out at lower rents, actually to go to the market and allow market rents to fall. Anyway, I'm joined by Eddie James, who operates the Ark Bar in Bristol City Centre. Hi, Eddie, and welcome to Drive Time.
And thanks for inviting me.
Right, can you just tell us about this whole thing of the business rates? We very rarely hear about business rates, do we?
Well, the National Federation of Property Owners, they say there's some 15 million square foot of property that has been deliberately demolished. Bristol seems to be high on that list. Recently, or about a year ago, I believe the actual building, the Evening Post, you know, our bastion of fairness, actually pulled their own building down, or they, in mysterious circumstances, they sold half the building, evidently a crew came in to wreck it, and actually pulled their roof down as well, which wrecked the whole building, which is rather strange.
But that was because they wanted to move their print operation out of Bristol to Didcot, which they've done.
Yes, but then there's no reason to sacrifice a building like that. I mean, obviously it was a cost-cutting affair, so the circumstances are quite suspicious how that took place.
Yeah, there are other buildings on Temple Way that have also been demolished. The one opposite the Evening Post.
That's correct.
I'm not sure. I think it was Clerical Medical Insurance Building. This was demolished within a month of this getting rid of these business rate relief. So the principle basically is that rather than admit that they can't get a commercial rent, they have to have a lower rent for these buildings to allow businesses to start up, businesses to move in at lower rents, they would rather demolish the building than pay those rates.
Absolutely, which is a great loss to the ratepayers. Obviously, if let's say it's a £100,000 building, 100,000 square foot, and I think the actual rates equates about between £5 and £6, per square foot. That means there's £600,000 lost by that one building alone. But it extends further into the centre. The Artichoke Pub, I don't know if we ever all remember that, and that was part of a complex that was raised about 4 years ago. There's been no sign of building. My concern is that Bristol City Council are responsible for these sites in a sense. If they allow these speculators to do that, and when the Evening Post are doing it, then in a way you have to draw the conclusion that there is no democracy within the Bristol City Council. Another building which is very serious was the Landmark building that was the end of the 32, the M32, which was part of the Cabot Circus rebuild. Now that building was some 15 stories.
Was this that gigantic Norfolk House, the triangular thing?
The triangular, a beautiful building in a sense, but very robust. That could have housed maybe 200 families. The site that it occupied has not been built on. They also took out the car park, which was a local car park. I think it was Tollgate Car Park, used to have lots of kind of benefits for the local population, like car boot sales, etc. That ceased, and so we took down a whole building and just for the sake of expediency.
But at the end of the day, if you're a property owner and you own this property, what you want to do is you want to make the maximum value out of it. And if it's going to be empty because you can't rent it out, you don't want to have to be paying those business rates once a year, a massive slice, when you're not actually getting an income from the building.
I understand that. I mean, that actually does put the council to shame, maybe. But nevertheless, that's the law we live under. And the fact is that by taking out that building, we lose the opportunity to put some low-cost industries in there, small industries, even small housing, because at the end of the day, the council is responsible for the people. That's what we pay our wages for.
But this is, the decisions about how business rate relief used to work, how it works now, these are not decisions that Bristol City Council takes. These are central government treasury decisions.
Well, that's true, but I don't see much response from Bristol City Council to the major government anyway. But the important thing to me is that there is no real kind of opposition to the pulling down of these buildings, if they know. And the other factor is the environmental cost. The environmental cost to the environment is massive, because these buildings are perfectly serviceable. Some of these buildings are less than 30 years old. They have a 100-year lifespan. So demolishing those is contrary to any ethical process. And the Bristol City Council, unfortunately, claim to be a green city, but in retrospect, they're not.
Martin, I'll bring you in here, because this, particularly the Clerical Medical Building on Temple Way, was a very new building, and it seemed that it wasn't being rented out, even though, of course, it's on that company's books as if it was going to be rented out. The value on the company's books as a fixed asset, this massive building, is there as if it was being rented out. And what bothers me is it seems that there isn't any kind of real market in rents, because everybody that actually is renting is afraid to allow the rents to drop to a market level. But if they did drop to a market level, this would be fantastic for small start-up businesses.
Yeah, but of course the Clerical Medical would lose money, and that's not their motivation. And as you rightly pointed out, these decisions have been taken out of the hands of local government by the last Tory government.
So it's really decisions by an accountants, who are saying, actually, we don't want to rent this building out at a market rent, because a real market rent would be less than its value. That would mean we'd have to take a massive chunk off of our fixed assets on our balance sheet.
Exactly. It sounds very like the banks, doesn't it? I mean, isn't this an absurd economic system we live in, where we build a clerical medical building less than 10 years ago, we don't rent it out to anybody, and then we knock it down and everybody says what a jolly good job we've done? It's madness, isn't it? Absolute madness. But what we really need to do is, if people are not using a building, the reason why you put a rate on it or something like that is that if you're not going to use it, you've got to give it to us, basically. And we need to change the rules, because of course everything is geared in favour of the private owner. And in actual fact, the private owner, if they're not prepared to use it properly, it should be taken off them, just like that.
Yeah. What's your thoughts about this whole business of the potential to actually really make Bristol a hub for small businesses to get going with these real commercial, much lower rents?
I think it's an absolutely wonderful chance, and also to move away from the centralisation or the pockets of kind of commerce and enterprise that the council seems to carve up. Like, for instance, you have the Temple Quarter and then you have Cabot Circus. It's almost as though they can't conceive that you can have mixed industry. But before I answer that question, I'd like to go on to the Cabot Circus itself. I mean, Cabot Circus is a private enterprise, okay? It could disappear tomorrow. They could demolish it. There's nothing stopping them. And yet, there's so much of our public land been given over to them. And the fact that they could demolish it and they could walk away from that is a serious indictment against the council for putting themselves into position. Because with Cabot Circus, they took away private public roads. They gave them to the unit, but there's no guarantee that will stay as a public service, you know, forever and ever.
But the thing is, Eddie, it's been a roaring success. You know, Cabot Circus is absolutely packed with people over Christmas. We're going to see tailbacks over the weekends, particularly all the way down the M32, as people come from all around the region into Bristol. It's a draw. It brings people in.
I have to disagree with that. It's a shopper's paradise, maybe, but I live in St Paul's, and I have to tell you that St Paul's has been isolated since that. It's hard to get across the road. We've lost our walkways. It's a danger. It's a nightmare. It might be a shopper's paradise, but most of these shoppers don't even live in Bristol. As far as Bristol's concerned, it's a nonsense bit of real estate, because there's nothing really of much integrity that local people need, and all it's done is, you know, it's really just a nightmare. The fact is,
and it's quite expensive too.
It's expensive, and also the other factor is that mileage terms, what they've done is, by not having an underpass, you have to kind of reroute yourself. So if you're coming from the west to east, you have to go half a mile up and then come half a mile back to go to Templemead. So in terms of the environment, you know, Cabot Circus is an absolute disaster.
Okay, so what would you do over this business rate issue, though, to actually open these places up? I mean, we've got Hamilton House, for example, on Stokes Croft, which is quite a low rent, and loads of these kind of creative industries have moved in there. Why can't we do that in other parts of the city, in these masses of empty offices we've got?
That's right. And why did we need... I mean, we have Cribbs Corner. If people want a shopping experience, they can go there. To put Cabot Circus in the middle of what was old Bristol was a fundamental mistake, because it doesn't really answer any of the problems that, you know, local people need at all. And the other factor is that you can't actually cross the road safely anymore, you know. So if you're a young mother and you want to go from St Paul's to the centre, you have to actually fight the traffic, pedestrians. So we've lost our overhead walkways. We used to have two of those. So it is an actual danger, you know, to youngsters, because they spend longer in contact with the traffic.
Are you saying that the youngsters won't wait for the green man before they cross?
If they wait for the green man, when do they? And not so young do as well. But my point is that it's the pollution level. While you're, you know, ingesting this stuff on the side of the road, whereas you could have walked across the two high-level crossovers, one at McDonald's and one further around, you now have to wait. And in some cases, there's three stations before you get across the road. So a mum with a baby could be exposed to traffic for at least 5 or 6 minutes, whereas before they could have just hopped over the bridge. And also, the local people can't even get through the car park. So the car park is basically just for people coming out of town into Bristol. You know what I mean? So as far as the local people at Bristol, Cabot Circus is not all it's cracked up to be. You know what I mean?
Okay, Eddie, thanks very much for joining us on Drive Time this evening.
It's been a pleasure.
Bristol Community FM 93.2.
Now, equally important for many is to look at the Palestine-Israel problem, and it's deadlock as the Palestinians attempt to get their bid for the UN recognition going. But William Hague, the Foreign Secretary, is not in favour, and last week he explained why.
The Admissions Committee of the Security Council will conclude its consideration of the Palestinian application and produce a report summarising Council members' views on whether Palestine meets the criteria for membership under the United Nations Charter. As this could now soon be followed by a vote in the UN Security Council, it is appropriate to inform the House of the Government's intentions. The United Kingdom judges that the Palestinian Authority largely fulfills criteria for UN membership, including statehood, as far as the reality of the situation in the occupied Palestinian territories allows, but its ability to function effectively as a state would be impeded by that situation. A negotiated end to the occupation is the best way to allow Palestinian aspirations to be met in reality and on the ground. We will not vote against the application because of the progress the Palestinian leadership has made towards meeting the criteria. But nor can we vote for it while our primary objective remains a return to negotiations through the quartet process and the success of those negotiations. For these reasons, in common with France and in consultation with our European partners, the United Kingdom will abstain on any vote on full Palestinian membership of the UN. We reserve the right to recognise a Palestinian state bilaterally at a moment of our choosing and when it can best help bring about peace. The United Kingdom will continue to be one of the principal supporters of Palestinian state-building efforts.
Now, Martin, that was William Hague speaking last week in the House of Commons about the whole idea of a bid for Palestinian statehood at the United Nations. And he says, announced that, that the UK's ambassador to the United Nations Security Council will abstain.
Well, I think that's a shame. Basically, Britain should be seen to be supporting the Palestinians, since it was Britain who basically invited Israel to exist in the first place. So we've got a special responsibility here. And frankly, William Hague has let us down.
But he's saying there should be a return to negotiations.
He needs to tell that to the Israelis, because they're the ones who don't want to negotiate, and they've been trying to drag their heels all the way. I mean, actually, what we did with Serbia in the 1990s, when they did what the Israelis did in Gaza a couple of years ago, you know what we did? We had a 43-day bombing campaign against them. We made them change the government. Maybe we need to bomb a few Israeli television stations, get them to understand that when Britain says no, we mean no. That's what we told Slobodan Milosevic, isn't it? That's what we should be telling Benjamin Netanyahu, in a polite tone of voice, of course.
Now also joined by Rita Kanjalusi, who's part of the Bristol Palestine Solidarity Campaign. Hi, Rita. Welcome to Drive Time.
Hi.
What are your thoughts about the whole idea of getting recognition at the United Nations for the Palestinian state?
Yeah, I agree they should have recognition. I added to Martin, Britain, they actually allowed war criminals from Israel, like Tzipi Livni, I think her name is,
yep,
to she's the first guest at 10 down in street, which I was there protesting. I wrote a letter to my MP without any answer. And
who is your MP?
Charlotte
Leslie.
Yeah. So basically, if I kill someone, I will go straight to prison, and she's responsible for almost 1,500 dead civilian, mostly civilian children, and she's allowed to go everywhere freely. This is disgusting.
Okay, thanks, Martin. Thanks, Rita. Now, Martin, finally, can you say what you think there is the prospects for the Palestinian state, the presence at the United Nations? Because it would seem, if you're going to have a United Nations, all nations should be represented.
Well, indeed, and in actual fact, if there was a vote in the Security Council at large or in the General Assembly, the Palestinians would win. They just got elected to UNESCO, for example, and the Americans immediately threw a fit on behalf of the Israelis and said they're going to withdraw their funding. Now, I say this in all honesty, the Israelis should be read the Riot Act, as Slobodan Milosevic was read the Riot Act a decade ago, and they've got to be put in exactly the same place. And when, in fact, Britain decided to go to war over Kosovo, Ariel Sharon did not support us. And you know why? Because we were setting a precedent, which is there are going to be no land grabs in the 21st century. And Israel is the biggest land grabber on the planet. They must be told no.
And we'll be hearing a little bit more about that later.
Bristol Community FM 93.2.
Now, this week was quite surprising to hear the former boss of MI5 coming out in support of the decriminalisation of cannabis. But amongst the most controversial of drugs, this is. Many people, particularly in Bristol's Afro-Caribbean community, use cannabis. And we're going to hear now from Steve Barker from the Legalised Cannabis Alliance, which is based in Norfolk, about the raising of cannabis from Class C to a Class B drug a couple of years ago, which controversially has enabled the police to hit their drug enforcement targets by focusing less time on the crack and heroin dealers, who are more closely linked to prostitution and serious organised crime. Let's have a listen then to Legalised Cannabis Alliance representative Steve Barker, and I'll be giving you their advice line number after this.
My name is Steve Barker. I'm a member of the Legalised Cannabis Alliance. We have a Skype meeting once a week to discuss policy. We've been running since 1998. For 10 years, we were a political party, and we fought round about 50 seats, both local seats and national parliamentary seats, and gained a total of round about 20,000 votes. We decided to operate as a non-aligned pressure group. Subsequently to that, the government decided to put cannabis back into Class B, which wasn't a move that we'd anticipated. And so it's really like starting over again to make people aware of the situation, the social situation regarding cannabis.
Now, what was the reasoning behind the lifting of cannabis from Class C up to Class B? And what was the fallout from the government's advisers?
In fact, they went against the advice of all the experts that they had to do this. Of course, we weren't party to that decision. We can only speculate as to why they decided to put it back into Class B. One can look at the vested interests that are involved in these decisions, and one interesting aspect of it was, whilst it was in Class C, the police were still active, and they were going round to people who had grow rooms and taking photographs. When it was back into Class B, since then they'd be going around arresting those same people. So they may have thought that it was likely to go back into Class B, or they may have been petitioning for it to go back into Class B during that time.
Now, is it, do you think, easier for the police to take on the cannabis growers and the cannabis traffickers rather than maybe the heroin or crack people?
Particularly in this area, they're leaving the heavier Class A people alone and concentrating on the cannabis. In fact, one has to look at the dynamics of the criminal justice industry, which includes the police, the courts, the prisons, and the fact that they are committed to a policy which is called OBTJ, Offenders Brought to Justice. So they're seeking to increase the number of people brought to justice and also reduce the cost of it. Not many people realise that arrests are put on a cost-effective scale. So they're looking for people they can bring to justice for the minimum amount of cost. The other thing is that judges are committed to keep an eye on the cost of running their courts. A Crown Court costs £15,000-£20,000 a day to run, and they don't like having to pay out a lot of money and then get an acquittal at the end of it. They're expected to get a high proportion of convictions. These things distort the criminal justice situation. Another thing is, I would say, about the way that police operate is they traditionally use informers. Now, if they're dealing with terrorists or they're dealing with safe crackers, then they get people in there to keep an eye on it who are actually informing the police. In the case of drugs, this was explained by Eddie Ellison, who was the former head of the drug squad. He said, in normal cases of a crime, you have three people involved. You've got the police, you've got the victim, and you've got the perpetrator. Now, in the case of drugs cases, you haven't got a victim, so you've got the police and the perpetrator.
But isn't the person that ultimately is taking the drugs and that are damaging their life, they're the victim, surely?
Well, the point about it is that people take drugs because they choose to do so. They're not forced to take
drugs. Well, what about addicts? They don't, do they?
If we deal with the addict a bit later on, like, I'm looking at drugs which are not addictive. So suddenly you've got the police in connection with the perpetrators, which are the dealers and the users. This kind of prohibition is pretty much based on alcohol prohibition in the 20s and 30s in the United States. It was the same people who moved over and formed the Federal Bureau of Narcotics and applied it to what was called marijuana. Nobody knew what marijuana was at the time because it was a Mexican slang term for canamo, which is the actual Spanish word for cannabis. It was actually brought in by newspaper owners and police enforcement officers. There was no medical or social consideration in the prohibition of cannabis. So to go back to the first point that we're making, that once you've got informers, this means that you've got informers who are actually working in conjunction with dealers, in theory. But in actual practice, this means that there are certain dealers that police leave alone because they are giving the information about their clients to the police for the helpline. I can give you my telephone number, which is 01508 480528. And I can give you the LCA website, which is lca-uk.org. Information website, a news website, and a discussion forum.
That was Steve Barker there from the Legalise Cannabis Alliance. Now, Martin, he's essentially saying that, that although we're seeing a lot of focus on cannabis as a drug, it's actually that really the crack and the heroin the police should really be spending more time on rather than the cannabis, because it's more the crack and heroin are more linked with violence, burglary, and organised crime.
Yeah, I do kind of agree with that, although I'd point out that any illegal market is a criminal market. And we had Danny Kushnick here from Transform, as you know, last week, Tony. And the argument for legalisation is not about whether drugs are good or bad for you. By and large, they're bad for you, including cannabis. You know, there are clearly some health issues associated with cannabis, not least that it's often smoked with tobacco. But the fact of the matter is the illegal market sets up situations like we saw in the Stephen Lawrence affair, where local drug dealers buy cops and then murders are not properly investigated. The corruption associated with illegal markets has got to end, and that's why we've got to legalise.
Now, do you think it's significant that Eliza Manning and Buller, the former head of MI5, the Director General of MI5, has come out this week, along with other crossbench Baroness Meacher as well, saying that cannabis particularly should be decriminalised?
Well, it's a step in the right direction. Portugal decriminalised possession of all illegal drugs some time ago, and what they found, what happens if you get caught in possession of illegal drugs, is that they sometimes get confiscated off you, you get a little lecture about your health, and then you go home.
But how significant is it that our own intelligence service head is intervening here?
Well, ex-intelligence. I think because people like that are informed about the way the world works, how the drug cartels bailed out the banking system in 2008, for example, which is in the UN report on drugs and crime that came out in 2009. Basically, our financial system has become dependent upon illegal drug money. At this point, we have to sort of take a step back and say, hang on a minute, something has to be done about this. And it's not just keeping PC Plod chasing around after people growing cannabis.
BCFM 93.2. Bristol is our community.
Now, are we starting something called the Tenth Crusade? We had 9 crusades back in medieval times, but more noises this week that NATO may attack or invade Syria and Iran. But is this just like the old medieval crusade, a war for plunder under the guise of religion? And are our Goldman Sachs financing it all? Well, we'll be exploring that in a minute. But first, Marina Morris has been out on the streets this week asking you what you think about this new possible confrontation with Iran and all the reasons behind it.
Should Iran have the right to develop nuclear power?
It's a hot topic. There's a lot of people who have done it already, so it's very difficult for anyone to come along now and say that they don't have the right. But having said that, of course, really, we should be working towards a world that where the chances of a nuclear war are zero, really. It would have to be very heavily regulated.
It's not a hot topic I'm really aware about, but sure, if it's only for nuclear power, not weapons. I guess it's something to do with the UN and different things?
Probably not. But that's probably more because of a perceived danger. There may not actually be any danger to them having nuclear power, as opposed to any other country, a Muslim country. There's a feeling that it would be fundamentalists and dangerous, but I've got no basis of any evidence to say that. Just a feeling you get from the press.
I think yes, they should do. I can see a global risk in the fact that if they develop nuclear power, it is also very closely related to nuclear weapons, which is why we got worried and went in there.
I personally think no. If we had another world war, then it would be catastrophic, so no. But if other countries have, then why do we need another country to condone it when it's a bad thing in the first place?
I mean, I for one, I am favourable for nuclear power. So if it can be used in a responsible manner, then I don't see why not.
Are you concerned about Iran developing nuclear weapons?
Yes, although not specifically just Iran. I think I'm concerned about anybody developing nuclear weapons, really. That we should be working towards a world where nuclear weapons aren't seen to be required by anybody. And at the moment, obviously, they're only really used as a deterrent. But we need to be working toward a point where everyone can be trustworthy enough to not to require them.
Possibly. I guess they've got a lot of reasons to be have a grudge against the Western world.
Yes, because I'd wonder why any country that didn't currently have them would feel a need to have nuclear weapons now.
Now that the war has started, yes, I am, because obviously they might strike us with it.
Yeah.
I think you're trying to say that we should be trying to stop nuclear weapons, not have other countries developing more.
Whether they will or not, don't think that's one I can answer. But if they are planning, then obviously that is something I would be concerned about.
Concerned about any country actually doing any kind of weapon.
Should we attack Iran to stop them?
No, definitely not. Completely irresponsible, I would dare say illegal as well, and I think I just sent out completely the wrong message, really, myself. This is an issue which affects everybody globally now because of the way that the world works. And I think that really this is the kind of thing that needs to be worked on globally. You need the right people, the leaders of of all the major countries, really, need to come together and form some kind of agreement on this. I mean, nuclear power is a different matter. I mean, that is something which is almost definitely going to be required by all of us now to feed the needs of the country and the global demand for power, really.
Definitely not. No more war. We've had enough war in the last...
No. I think you've got international communities set up where you put pressure on countries and you may even have sanctions against them. To attack another country for simply having something you've got doesn't really seem particularly fair to me. I think you'd be better off finding out why they really felt they had a need for them.
At the moment, I think we shouldn't attack Iran because they're not developing nuclear weapons at the moment. But if they do, then we should possibly do something about it. Not necessarily military-wise, but maybe diplomatic or something.
No, I think it's probably a bit too early for that, till you get some sort of concrete evidence that something like that is happening. You don't want another Iraq situation, to be honest. So
no. That is like an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. I don't believe in that at all. No.
That was Marina Morris out on the streets asking you what you think about this sort of impasse at the moment with the whole situation with Iranian nuclear power and the potential for developing nuclear weapons. Now, Martin, one of the points that was brought across there was why might the Iranians feel they need nuclear weapons?
Well, it's pretty logical. The Israelis have got at least 400 nuclear weapons and they've threatened to use them in at various times on the Iranians. The Americans are threatening to attack them if they don't change their regime, which they don't like. Terrorist actions are going on inside Iran. We know that this explosion this week in their missile complexes may have been a Mossad bomb attack. Can you imagine if the Iranians were bombing bases in Britain, how we would feel about that? I don't think the Iranians need nuclear weapons because I think if it comes to war between Iran, the West and Israel, Iran will win. And that's a pretty clear guess by the Russians and the Chinese as well. They've got lots of really good Russian and Chinese kit. If it comes to a war, the Iranians will win and the West will deserve to lose.
Now, the argument was discussed a bit on with Syria, particularly on with the Russians actually weighing in, saying, look, it's really important that you don't do another Libya with Syria, because this seems to be rolling on. We've had Iran in the background the whole time. We've had now Libya, now Syria, and other Middle Eastern countries that the West has sort of targeted.
And Somalia and Yemen.
And these are all sort of surrounding the Iranians. The Iranians seems to be the objective at the end of the day. We also had Wesley Clark, the American general, saying that the Pentagon, they had secret plans to attack all these countries, sort of 8 years ago at the time of the September 11th attacks. So, do you think the Russians are right to say, Syria, you've got to just leave it alone and let this civil war, like Libya, work its course?
What the Russians are saying is you need to actually have a mediation between the different factions in Syria. Syria is a much more complicated country than Libya. And the other thing is that we've got the Free Syrian Army this week attacking Syrian army bases, killing hundreds of people. They say 3,000 plus people have died in what's going on in Syria, but a large proportion of them, or a substantial proportion of them, are Syrian security forces that have been fighting with armed militants. Now, at some point, people have got to recognise that politics is not just about, oh, Assad's a bad guy and the other guys are good guys, just like the people who've taken over in Libya are not necessarily good guys and Gaddafi's a bad guy. I was an aid worker in Bosnia. Do you know what the truth is? All of them are bad guys.
And,
all of them.
And I noticed,
and you have to talk to everybody.
And I noticed that Baroness Ashton was over talking to Mr. Lavrov, the Russian foreign minister, foreign secretary, this week about Syria. But I'm bothered because nobody's ever actually elected her as an EU representative. She's representing the whole of the European Union, apparently, but she's completely unelected.
Yeah, but I mean, nobody elects any of our diplomats, Tony, and she's in that role, if you see what I mean. The diplomats are professionals, and often the professionals talk sense to the I mean, if you listen to the Republican candidates in the US, they are openly calling for terrorist attacks inside Iran. They're openly calling for the assassination of their senior people. They're actually carrying it out. And basically, if I was the Iranians, I'd just say to the Americans, if you carry on talking like that, we will presume you are going to attack us. And in that case, we're not going to wait. We're going to attack you. Straits of Hormuz closed. Aircraft carriers sunk. Off we go. Call World War III. And if I was the Iranian general staff, I wouldn't wait for them to start it. If you're going to keep talking war, we're going to give you war. And that's what's so wrong about the West's attitude to all of this and the Israeli attitude to all of this. If you keep talking war, the Iranian general staff might give it you with the backup of the Russians and the Chinese, and you might not like it. So just shut up and put up.
Now, we've heard before on this show about Peter Eyre. This week he was on Russia Today, raising again this term, the New World Order, describing some of the attitudes of the Western powers towards the Middle East. But what does he actually mean by it? Let's have a listen now to Peter Eyre.
I think we have to turn the clock back to the original collapse of the world economy, because this was no accident. It was a very well-planned exercise by the New World Order, who have the ability to close down any company or any country at will. As we know, Ireland became a victim, Portugal, and now Greece, and apparently Spain and Italy are likely to follow. It really doesn't matter who's in power. There are people that are controlling this situation. We also have to understand that there's massive corruption, fraud taking place, and tax evasion in most countries that are actually creating this problem.
Well,
remember that they can take out any country financially or militarily that they want to take out. This is a master plan of what I call the New World Order. Their priorities are, one, to secure the world's natural resources. Their second one is to control the markets for those resources. And thirdly, is to control the gateways, the sea lanes, and the pipeline routes. When you have control of this, you basically have got the world in the palm of your hand. Whoever controls the finances of the world controls the world. And this is what we're looking at here.
You know, it sounds almost like a sort of crazed master plan to take over the world, Martin. Is it really that crazed?
Well, I mean, Peter Eyre's stuff on the missing nuclear weapons from South Africa and the involvement of our own lovely Tory leadership in losing them is more interesting than his comments on this. Basically, I agree with him, but I think using the word New World Order leads to confusion because everybody thinks they know what it means.
I think if we just ignore that for a second and look upon it as a sort of financial oligarchy
oligarchy in the West is determined to recreate the 19th century empires. That's exactly what is happening, with America playing the role of Great Britain. And of course, they're finding resistance as they do this, and they are leading the world to disaster. You feel like saying this is the 21st century, guys. For goodness sake, we're a tiny little speck in the middle of nowhere. We need to cooperate with everybody. Let's talk to the Chinese. Let's talk to the Iranians. What can we do together to solve the problems we all face? HIV, immigration, environmental degradation, poverty. That's what should be happening. Never mind playing 19th century games with 21st century weapons. But I'm afraid the criminal oligarchy that runs the West are beyond redemption.
And what bothers me is that you've got a sort of linkage with NATO and the military.
Of course. It's NATO versus SCO. The Shanghai Cooperation Organization. And Iran is about to be admitted as a full member of the SCO, and the SCO is NATO's counterpart. So any attack on Iran, if they do become full members of the SCO, becomes an attack on the SCO, and that obliges Russia and China to come in behind them. And of course the Chinese warned us off fighting with Pakistan after this ridiculous Bin Laden incident in Abbottabad. That wasn't really told to us on Radio 4, was it? Basically, the Russians and the Chinese and the Iranians are saying to the West, back off now, but of course they're not going to, so we're probably going to war, and the West will lose.
Well, one of the most worrying aspects of all this, and one that makes it look very much like a war of religious fanaticism, like the old Crusades, is the Christian Zionist movement, which is very strong in the United States. Here, Irving Wesley Hall describes some of the main beliefs of the Christian Zionists, who many believe are religious fundamentalist fanatics, far more dangerous than Islamic fundamentalists.
Christian Zionism, or as it's also called, dispensationalism, believes that the Jewish people from throughout the world must all return to the Holy Land. And the state of Israel must conquer all of the land between the Nile River in Egypt and the Euphrates River in Iraq. They must blow up the mosques on the Temple Mount in Jerusalem, and for 3.5 years after they have rebuilt their temple and reestablished the Levitical practices of animal sacrifice, for 3.5 years they will worship the Antichrist. Jesus Christ will return and lead an army of hundreds of thousands and kill off all of the Jews, with the exception of 144,000, who will promptly convert to Christianity. A second element is the belief in the imminence of tribulation, part of an end-time scenario in which the human race itself will be destroyed in a holocaust inevitably involving nuclear war.
Now, Martin, that was Professor... That was Irving Wesley Hall there describing Christian Zionism. Why haven't we heard very much about this whole sort of Christian Zionist religious fanaticism? Because they're saying it's all based on the Bible.
Well, I mean, they've got no real influence in this country, but of course in United States politics they really do have influence. In George Bush they had a believer in the White House, and the same with Ronald Reagan, and that's the kind of stupid thing they believe. Aren't you scared out there, Middle England, when you realise who's in charge? They believe this stuff, they really do.
Yes, it's a bit worrying. But anyway, Professor Anthony Hall has written a new book about propaganda of empire building since 1492, and he believes the formula is essentially the same now, and nothing much has changed for the last 400 years.
Anthony J. Hall, I've just finished a 16-year project, 2 volumes. Collectively, those 2 volumes are The Bowl with One Spoon. Volume 1 is The American Empire and the Fourth World. Volume 2 is Earth into Property, Colonization, Decolonization, and Capitalism. I'm happy to announce that Earth into Property was chosen by The Independent as one of the best books of 2010. I look at the process of globalization since 1492. I look at empire building, and I look at the resistance of indigenous peoples and how indigenous peoples, by combining together, creating larger coalitions, have been engaged in a form of anti-imperial globalization. And I try to situate the movement that doesn't accept that global capitalism, controlled by a few powerful corporations, that this is the destiny at the end of history. I've tried to draw on that history of indigenous peoples in opposing and resisting earlier forms of imperial globalization, and saying we can draw on that history to understand better where we are in history and how we can join together and form coalitions and develop ideas of ourselves in bigger and bigger ways, transnational ways that we can develop along with, let's call it the Tahrir Square Global Freedom Movement. I mean, obviously, when you look at Mubarak and the crimes and oppressions of that regime in Egypt, who put Mubarak there? Mubarak was, you know, in a sense, a middle manager in a much larger global system, a global empire. So we need to oppose that. We need to find ways to resist that, to redirect history towards a sustainable, ecological, viable way of life
not develop economics that actually conform with ecology, conform with how nature, which is ultimately the real economy and where all our good things, where all our health, where all our nourishment ultimately comes from, the natural world, you know, we're destroying it. This capitalist system that we live in now, our life maintenance systems actually are killing the natural system, the true economy that we need to sustain ourselves. So how do we oppose this? How do we transcend the poisonous mental environment? For instance, War of 1812, I just gave a paper on Dick Cheney, his new book, his new memoir. He gives his reflections on 9/11, and he looks back at the War of 1812, and he says, the British burned down the White House back in the War of 1812, and now Al-Qaeda has shown it can hit us in our midst. Well, actually, during the War of 1812, indigenous peoples following Tecumseh created a larger confederacy of peoples and worked with the British Empire in the hopes of creating like a fixed polity within the British Empire. It would probably have been called Indiana, north of the Ohio River. So there's an example of indigenous peoples resisting, making alliances. So we're going to have to make alliances. We're going to have to build bigger and bigger coalitions of power. For instance, trade unionism, we have to draw on that history of organizing workers. Workers can have a tremendous influence by withholding their labor. That's a very important thing. You know, the Battle of Seattle, it was sometimes referred to as turtles to teamsters. You know, the environmentalists, the ecologists trying to make the world a place where turtles can survive, where frogs can survive, where buffalo can rejuvenate themselves, where, you know, we can have biodiversity. That's a whole important political movement, ideological, intellectual, even spiritual movement. Women still continue to be oppressed in our own societies and in many societies, and we need to address that. So we need to think how these ecological issues fit with women's issues, gender issues, and ultimately, you know, the anti-war movement has been so important historically. To my way of thinking, until you deal with the lies and crimes of 9/11, it's very hard to deal with the invasions that come out of these lies and crimes. That in order to be effective as the peace movement, as the anti-war movement, you have to deal with the roots of this current succession of wars that we're told again and again that are to oppose terrorism. I mean, the very concept of a war on terror, what a monstrosity, what an idiocy. I mean, war is terror. How do you have war against terror? The religious communities of the world, I mean, after all, Judaism, Christianity, Islam, were all Abrahamic religions. Go back to a common source, it's all monotheistic religions coming out of a trajectory of history. So we need to move beyond the way this global war on terror is presented, as if the West is a trajectory of Judeo-Christian history and Islam is some sort of aberrant, is the other, is the enemy. No, Islam is deeply rooted in Western civilization, going back to Andalusia, Al-Andalus, you know, the history of the Zero, the history of the Renaissance. So much of our memory from the Greco-Roman era comes from Islamic scholars who saved this and interpreted this. So we have to develop historical consciousness, political consciousness, ecological consciousness, in some way that we can get back to understanding our shared humanity and embracing our shared humanity, and even beyond human beings, our relationships with the plant and animal world, which is the basis of our sustenance. We have to find ways to fight the war machine that wants to poison our mentalities, our consciousness. We need to move beyond this psychological warfare that we're fed every day, which tells us, you know, who we should hate, who are the good guys, who are the bad guys. You know, this coalition of media and police who tell us these are the bad people, these are the good people. And it's not only about phone hacking, it's right up, you know, much higher echelons of constructed hatred and constructed friendship. No, as human beings, we've got to transcend these signals, these incentives towards hatred and distrust and regain a sense of our shared humanity, our shared dependence on the natural world. And I suppose it comes down to love. I suppose it comes down to some kind of embrace. As human beings, there's much more that we share in common, and we certainly share a common destiny on this small, imperiled planet. And this giving so much power to the war machine to divide us, to make huge profits based on, you know, slaughtering people and destroying some populations in the name of these false ideals that are given to us, like anti-terrorism, anti-communism. Right in the Declaration of Independence, there is a proviso, you know, King George did bring on the merciless Indian savages, whose known means of warfare is undistinguished destruction of all ages, sexes, and conditions. I mean, right in the Declaration of Independence is the sort of roots of the global war on terror. Merciless Indian savages, they're terrorists. Those sitting on the resources that you're about to appropriate in the founding of your new country, you're creating this new country to push west, to incorporate new lands and incorporate new capital into your system. Right from the inception of the United States of America, that population is demonized as merciless Indian savages who are terrorists, who will do unpredictable violence to men, women, you know, to children, elders, disabled. So we're living in a time where these old memes are being recycled, and we need to learn some history. We need to transcend these lies and these psychological operations that are poisoning and destroying our chances for a decent life, for our posterity, for our kids, for seven generations hence. You know, when we make decisions, we should be thinking, well, how is that going to affect our offspring seven generations hence, the Iroquoian people? That's a very common turn of phrase. Of course, my books start with the colonization of indigenous peoples in the Western Hemisphere in 1492. And I kind of look to indigenous peoples who faced imperial globalization for, you know, five centuries, that they could be at the leadership, that they can give us their insights from generations and generations of opposing these imperial thrusts that seize resources and seize wealth and dispossess and marginalize peoples.
That was Professor Anthony James Hall there, and he's from the Canadian University of Alberta. His book, Earth into Property, Colonization, Decolonization and Capitalism, the paperback's about £20. Martin, why is this relevant today?
Because the same things are going on. As you said earlier, nothing much has changed. We're still demonising the Muslims as if they're the enemy, rather than just seeing them as fellow human beings. And we're still trying to steal their property. I understand lots and lots of US, British and US executives are piling into Libya to try and get oil contracts, but there's not elected government to deal with yet.
OK, that's all the serious talk out of the way. After this, it's the Fresh Blood Party with Pat Hart. Next week, the demise of the Immigration Advisory Service and Goldman Sachs controlling politicians. You'll find us at this week.org.uk.